I'm flipping through greeting cards from a new Hallmark collection called Eight Bamboo. It's a line of cards honoring Chinese American heritage by celebrating occasions specific to Chinese culture, but the one that catches my attention is doing something much simpler and much subtler than that. It's a card meant for new parents welcoming a new baby, and it's a lot like other cards already available for that purpose, but on the card, the baby that you see doesn't have a rosy complexion or golden tufts of hair like you would typically see on cards like these. This baby's got a shock of black hair, and it's clear from just a few minor details that the baby is of Asian descent. In other words, this baby looks like the actual child the recipient of the card is probably expecting to greet any day now. It's such a small thing and such a huge thing all at once. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're talking about four new multicultural card lines from Hallmark, one Chinese, one Indian, one African American, and one Latino. So far, they're getting rave reviews, but we want to know what you think. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. I've got two of the card creators here in the studio with me now. Monique Haupt is a product director at Hallmark, and she focuses specifically on cultural identity. Hi, Monique.
Hello.
What inspired these four card collections? What's the story there?
It's actually a pretty fascinating story. So as you probably know, Hallmark is about helping people share what's in their hearts. We're about connecting and helping people with their relationships. And part of our mission is around reflecting people's real lives and making sure that we enrich those relationships and we have a product available for all people. And so diversity and inclusion is important not only in the walls of Hallmark, but it's also important in the products and services that we deliver. So the background on these on this product was really around a need to go after multiple different things. So one being younger consumers, and so trying to make sure that we have product that's reflective of their lives and that can enrich their relationships, and also having product that's that is relevant to emerging consumer groups. And so, for instance, you mentioned the card in Eight Bamboo. And so we knew that this was the fastest growing segment of the population, the Asian population. And so we created card lines for Chinese Americans, like you said, and Indian Americans. That way we could reflect what was important in their lives and those specific occasions that would be meaningful to them.
So you're basically, on some level, the person who kind of makes some calls about whether a particular occasion or sentiment merits a greeting card. Is that right?
That's correct.
That is so cool, first of all.
Thank you.
But also, how does that process work?
So internally, we would look at consumer trends, consumer demographics, purchasing behavior, and other research data. We talk to consumers. I work with my creative partner who's here today, Christy, and we a lot of times come up with concepts that we can show consumers. But the process really is kind of end to end. It starts off with, do we have a need? Are there unsatisfied greeting needs out there that we could create product for? We make sure we have the right price. We make sure it's in the right place. We make sure the product, the actual items are going to meet their needs. And then we work with our retailers to get them on board, which they are generally very supportive because they see the need as well. It's their customers coming in their stores that are going to purchase it. And so it's a full end-to-end process that my team is very happy and excited to be a part of.
So were these new card collections created more on a principle, like the idea of representation, or was there a sense of external demand? Were people asking for these cards?
It's a little bit of both. But it's mostly around we saw a gap in our portfolio, right? So as we're looking at the demographics and we're saying, and it's four different lines. So each one of them has a different story. So as you think about Eight Bamboo and Golden Thread, we looked and said fastest growing population. There are specific occasions like the...
There's a Diwali car in Golden Thread.
Right. Mm-hmm. Or Eid or the baby car that you mentioned. And so those are specific needs that... There are other cards that would be okay for, but we love it when our consumers say they found the perfect card. And so felt like there was an opportunity to launch two brands, very targeted at each one of those different consumers. For Uplifted and Love You Mucho, both of those started in a slightly different fashion, is what I referenced earlier, in wanting to go after kind of that younger consumer. And so making sure we had product.
So Uplifted is...
Uplifted is a collection that we created that is about empowerment and affirmation, which is extremely important in the African-American community these days. It's about sisterhood. It was really created as a woman-to-woman sending collection.
So it's as specific as African-American women.
Well, that's our design target, right? But as we know, mahogany, very specifically, we've heard over the years, anytime I'm out in public and I'm showing product or I'm talking about the brand, people tell me all the time, I'm not black and I buy it and I love it. Or I just got a card for Mother's Day and I flipped it over and it was mahogany. So although that's our design target, a lot of the sentiment and a lot of the visuals on the card don't necessarily alienate anyone from buying it, right? And this country is becoming more multicultural and more multiracial. So even if I'm not, you may be, and I may be buying it for you. You may be my friend, you may be my sister-in-law, you may be my niece, right? And so whether you are African-American or not, you may or may not have a need for it. And we are finding more and more that people have that need, but that is our design target.
Well, I want to bring Christy Moreno in on this. Christy is an editorial director for Hallmark. She's the creative partner that Monique referenced earlier. And she's been working on these new cards, too. Hi, Christy.
Hi.
What exactly is your role in developing these card lines?
Well, I'm an editorial director, but editorial directors at Hallmark have a lot of things we do. And one of my favorite responsibilities is that I'm a consumer advocate, right? I don't just look at, oh, this message would be great on this card because, you know, it looks great and it has the same tone and the vibe. It really is looking at how would this message satisfy not just one need, right?
But yeah, you need more than one customer.
Yes, yes. And just listening to what Monique is saying, really what we're doing is that with all of these four collections in particular, is that we are creating product that is, as you said, not alienating, but that really halos out to intercultural relationships as well, right? We know that, and in particular, younger consumers, definitely Generation C is expecting every brand to really represent what their relationships are like. When I look at what I do as far as a consumer advocacy goes, and it's not just me, I have a wonderful team of very talented, creative people, and it's a very collaborative process where we look at, through research, what are the relationships like, right? I can tell you, for example, that a fifth of Latina women are marrying outside their ethnicity and outside their race. So what does that mean to family dynamics? What does that mean to how we are raising our children now? What are the values that we're instilling in them? What are the traditions that people are celebrating or incorporating into their lives?
Can you tell me the story of a specific card in the Love You Mucho line where you had to think about all of that to make that greeting card?
Yes, I have a card right here that I want to show you. And so Love You Mucho is really looking at what the Latinx trends are. We did a lot of social listening, which is looking at what are people sharing online, right? We know that a lot of relationships are now establishing communications and in the digital space, social media. So what are people proud to share? What are they commenting on? What are the hashtags that they're sharing? And what are the topics that are very relevant to them that they're actually wanting to share and replicate? And a lot of that, it really is based around women empowerment, young mothers seeking advice or giving advice, really supporting each other. And within the Latinx community and really outside, we all know that, I don't know if you're familiar with Mexican lucha libre, but this card actually has a Mexican wrestling mask and it's pretty striking design.
Yeah, it's purple and sparkly.
Purple and sparkly and just, you know, very, very
fun. Turquoise background.
Just very striking. We're gonna give you a link to look at our cards. But this card really is based around the concept of, you know, you're a fighter, you're strong, you're empowered, you're resilient. But it's married with this concept of it's a fun luchador mask. But then again, the message is really, you know, sharing, hey, I'm here for you.
And I've also noticed that the words on the card are about two words in English and one in Spanish.
Yes. So Love You Mucho is our main target, as Monique was sharing, is that we're looking at what were the gaps, what are the opportunities to grow our product offering. What we're seeing with young Latinos that are culturally fluid, that are English dominant, but that yet grew up either in a bilingual household or that they're retroculturating. We're living in an era where identity and cultural identity is very important. People are developing this stronger than ever. They want to know and they want to share what they stand for. And so within the Latinx demographics, we're looking at people are tracing back their heritage, their roots, and saying, this is what I want to latch onto. So this card in particular, it really is a representative of a very particular activity, right? The lucha libre, the sport. But overall, it's fun. People recognize what the icon is. And the message inside says, you're a fighter and nothing life throws at you. It's a match for you, right? So it's pretty awesome, yeah.
Can you tell me about your own background and cultural heritage?
Oh, yes. I am a proud Mexican-American. So I grew up in a bilingual and bicultural household. I was actually born in the United States, but raised in Mexico City, Mexico. And then I came back to the States for college, and I've been here since.
What? I wonder how you experience the cards in Hallmark's Love You Mucho collection as a potential consumer or recipient of one of the cards.
I love them. They're my babies. it is very interesting because Hallmark has had Spanish language cards for 3 decades. And that is certainly a very substantial part of our portfolio within cultural identity. But we really had this gap, right, in creating product that was representative of second, third generation
And just
Latinx.
A younger sensibility.
And a very younger sensibility, right? And so my relationship with Love You Mucho is really that, you know, there is a concept, there is an idea, there is a reason behind every single card. I work with a team of amazing designers and illustrators and writers and editors. This is certainly a big team effort, right? And we're very proud to see cards represent who we are as a team as well. Our team is very diverse. We have, as part of our creative team and cultural identity, we have people who self-identify as Afro-Latino, LGBTQ, bicultural. Help me out, Monique. I mean, there's just, you know, we have some Asian designers and illustrators as well. So there's a lot of sense of pride within our team and creating cards like this.
Monique, how do you relate personally to the cards in these collections? I understand that you actually received one.
I did. It's one of my favorites, and I have it here. So it is on a black background with white lettering on it that says, you are a Black history fact in the making. And on the inside, it says, you're on the come up and making sure others are coming up with you. That's power. That's grace. That's love. That's you. And it actually comes with this pretty phenomenal envelope that is designed on the inside. And on the outside of it, it says, hella inspired. So I received this card just a couple of months ago. And obviously, like we've talked about, I was a part of the team and we buy
each other. Familiar with the card.
I had seen the card once or twice or 100 times before. And we buy cards for each other within Hallmark for our birthdays and our work anniversaries. But I had recently received 2 awards, both pretty much centered around my passion for diversity and inclusion and for making sure people feel included within the walls of Hallmark. And so someone gave me this card to celebrate that award. And I was like, I read it and I was like, I'm a Black history fact in the making. Like, I didn't think of myself that way.
Yeah, you thought of other people who would receive
this
card.
I'm like, that's Martin Luther King. That's not Monique Haupt. But then as I really got to thinking about it, one of the awards I received was the first ever Champion of Inclusion Award at Hallmark. And I'm like, huh, I might actually be a Black History fact in the making. And it was pretty special because the person who gave it to me is a younger Hallmarker, younger in age and younger in number of years at Hallmark. And for her to view me that way, it wasn't about whether I saw myself as a Black History fact in the making. It was the fact that she saw me that way, that it was pretty special for me to receive this card. So as much as I look at a lot of the cards that we make and I'm like, I would buy that and I would buy that, I actually can't physically buy them all. and so when I actually receive one, I'm like, that was pretty special.
It also, it's pretty amazing that a card that you had helped to craft, that you felt differently about it when you received it.
Absolutely.
And you felt differently about yourself.
It became very personal at that point. Right. It gave me a sense of pride, but it also was very humbling because I'm like, people are watching me. The one thing I will say, and I would love for Christy to talk about this card with this young woman and the sweeping ponytail. It's one of my favorites in the Love You Mucho line.
Yeah, this one has a title that says Mujer, which means woman.
Oh, I liked this one too.
Be yourself. And it's a very beautiful kind of chalk-like illustration. It's a woman with hoops. She's very, you know, she has a nice, just poison stance.
And you see hair and accessories, but not a face, right?
Exactly.
Which I think makes it more, a little more universal.
More universal, more relatable. And it really is about capturing the essence of the soul and the essence of the person. Not necessarily about, you know, saying, oh, this is what she looks like, and maybe alienating someone and saying, I don't look like that. My friend doesn't look like that. But this card in particular, and I know this is a favorite of many people, I'll read the inside. It says, remember that you don't have to choose between being powerful or being liked, that it's possible to have a good head on your shoulders and cute hair too. You're an amazing woman, brilliant, bold, beautiful.
What's interesting about that card is, Christy alluded to the Vita brand, right? And it's mainly a Spanish language brand. And I think if you were to compare and contrast, it can tend to be a lot more traditional in its design. And so this is a fresh take on that, right? It's mostly in English. There's figural representation. To your point, it's still more a universal image, but you don't see a lot of that in our traditional Vita line. So I think when people would see Love You Mucho, either out at retail or at a trade show or wherever we were showcasing it, they're like, oh my God, this looks just like me, or I know someone who these would be perfect for.
And it's like just the aesthetic being a little bit reflecting maybe younger people's relationships with their
definitely.
Race and their culture. And
absolutely.
Okay, so that being said, I do not want to offend any Hallmark employees when I say this. I think a great card is a really special thing, and I so appreciate what you do. Greeting card messages can be cheesy. And I get it, because the card's got to speak to a lot of people's experiences. Mm-hmm. So, like, you as the card writer can't share a sentiment that's only mine and my mom's on Mother's Day because you need more than two people to buy your cards. But when you try to create a message that is both casting a wide net and also speaks to someone's really personal experience with race and culture and relationships, do you risk falling into a stereotyping trap? Is it hard to walk that line between acknowledging and pandering?
Well, I'm very happy that you're asking that question, because we take this very seriously, right? We have research really is our anchor. And we as a creative team, and I will answer that question because really it's in my realm. There are three buckets, I would say, or three sources that we really pay attention to. One is our internal team, right? I was sharing with you that within our team, not only do we have talent, but we have representation. And with representation, we're making sure that we have different lifestyles, different walks of life, different experiences, different generations. And so we really share and collaborate, and we share the needs. The second one is we have wonderful employee resource groups at Hallmark. Now, employee resource groups are conformed of all people or members of different areas and disciplines at Hallmark that self-identify or are allies of these groups. For example, we have a Latino group, we have an LGBT group, Q group, we have an African American group.
And the people can come from within your own team or elsewhere on the Hallmark staff.
Yes, so they can be coming from, you know, finance, or they can be coming from procurement or whatever other area. And they bring not only richness in perspective, but they're also seen as representing the market segments, right? And the third one is we take research seriously. So we talk to our consumers. We do focus groups. We show them what we're thinking. We share concepts, but we also take feedback seriously, right? So we make sure that in different levels and different stages, we are tapping to the wonderful resources that we have to validate what we're putting out the market.
So are you guys thinking about adding to these collections with cards tailored to other cultures and backgrounds? Are there more on the horizon?
We are always keeping our eye on the market, on the consumer evolving consumer base. And so I can't speak to anything that's on the horizon right now, but just know that we will always keep our eye on that. And if there's an opportunity to present itself, we would definitely tap into that.
So just thinking about the consumer experience, as I mentioned, I've read some really favorable reviews of these card lines. Mm-hmm. There are people who are really excited about these mm-hmm. cards and feel validated by them. And not just validated, but like, yeah, included in sort of a shared cultural experience.
They feel seen.
Going to get a greeting card where they don't have to sort of stretch to imagine it applying to them. What are some of your favorite responses? Have you heard about someone reacting to a card in a really profound way?
I want to share the 8 Bamboo Boba Tea card. And I don't know if you've seen it, Gina, but actually Kansas City hosted a few weeks ago the National Association for Asian American Professionals Convention. And we were there, not only as attendees, but we were there showcasing our product and really, you know, reading the pulse. What are people reacting? We were sharing our cards. We had a wonderful mailing station where they could actually pick a card and mail it out that very same moment. This boba tea card was one of our favorite one. And it's actually a blank card. You can do whatever you want with it, whatever message. But the feedback we heard constantly was like, this is so me and my friends. This is our thing. This is what we do. We don't do iced chai lattes. We don't do just regular coffee. We do boba. And so this is definitely one that has been a favorite among our consumers and our team as well.
Interestingly enough, this other card, which is in the Uplifted collection, that features a young little black girl with her natural hair and a crown on her head and a yellow dress, and her arms are crossed, and she's got a tinge of sass. At that same conference, so remember, Asian American professionals, a young Asian woman walked up and was like, "That's me." And we looked at each other and we're like, "Who's you?" And she was pointing at this young girl. And it wasn't obviously because she's black, because the woman who looked at her was Asian American. Now, she may also have African American in her, don't know. But it was really, as we talked to her, it was the attitude and the sassiness of the little girl that she saw in herself. And so, whereas for some people, you look at this and say, well, this card is very specifically for African American consumer because it has an African American girl on it. People can see themselves in lots of different ways, and they don't always take it literally. Yep. And so for her, it was about the attitude and the sass. And I loved her comment with her just walking up like, "There I am on a card." And we're like looking around like, "You're in the Uplifted section."
But you know what is also funny about that? I never thought about that. You know, you see little girls on birthday cards or whatever, mm-hmm. and it's always, you know, well-behaved. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Mm-hmm. Smile.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Pretty unconventional, right?
Yeah.
I would like to add that definitely several of these lines, particularly Love Ya Mucho and Uplifted, are really a direct response to the growing demand by women of color to see products that reflect themselves, that reflect who they really are, whether it's because they feel powerful and confident, multifaceted. I mean, the connections that they're really women are. You know, reclaiming definitions of what it means to connect with others, sisterhood, beauty, self-love.
Christy Moreno, Monique Haupt, thank you so much for joining us from Hallmark today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and in just a minute, we're talking about light pollution, searching out dark skies for stargazing. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now, when's the last time you looked up at the night sky and felt transfixed by a patchwork of shimmering stars? If it's been a while, that could be because all the artificial light in our night sky makes those stars harder to see. This is an issue all over the world, but Missouri is now home to its own chapter of the International Dark Sky Association, and they're about to start working with NASA's Missouri Space Grant Consortium to find dark skies over Missouri. Don Ficken joins us from St. Louis to talk about this. Don, good morning.
Good morning.
So what is the International Dark Sky Association, and why are you starting a chapter in Missouri?
Well, the International Dark Sky Association was founded in 1988, and it's really about addressing the issue of light pollution, which is nothing more than the inappropriate use of excess light. And it was a little bit to the extent of a research area to begin with, as they begin to get grassroots types of organizations like the state of Missouri involved. We're hoping to make changes to where we can actually avoid that. So we started our chapter last year. We're not even a year old, and we're simply trying to focus on the state of Missouri right now.
And then this partnership with NASA starting next month, can you explain that, what it will allow you to do?
Yes. We know a little bit about light pollution. There's satellites that we can take nice shots of the whole world. Very cool maps out there that you can see that. But it's not specific. We really would like to be able to create what's called a baseline of what's really going on in our state in particular areas, with the idea that once we understand the baseline and we start seeing how that light pollution changes over time, maybe we can make changes to stop that light pollution and get some pretty good feedback, some immediate feedback. And also, frankly, these projects help us engage the public a little bit, making them more aware of what's really going on. So it's a pretty nice project. We're actually having a lot of fun with it already.
How are you having fun with it already? Can you tell me?
Yeah, well, what happens is that as soon as you start, it's really interesting when you start talking with someone about measuring light pollution, or even just talk about the issue of light pollution to start with, they automatically start talking about stories about when they were growing up, and how they could see the stars, and they might be nature lovers, and how that, you know, affects maybe nature. So it's a great segue into that. And I think really in the state of Missouri, it's really interesting. You can look at some global maps and maps of the U.S., and if you look at how light is moving across the country, it's brightening, of course, very much in the east, and it's moving to the west. It's almost like a light tsunami is headed our way. And when I look and I see southern Missouri and up and maybe around the Kirksville area north, we have some pretty decent dark skies. I'd sure like to preserve some of that.
So how do you go about thinking about it? It's interesting to me to think about part of environmental conservation being a matter of preserving a dark sky. How do you go about that?
Well, first off, if you think about this, we have nature has been working at this millions and millions of years, right? It's all about when it's daytime, there's certain things happen in the daytime. When it's nighttime, things happen at night. And it's really coded around making that really happen. So when you're having that kind of changes happen, you just wonder really what's going on with the animals. And there's a lot of studies going on right now. I would say it's still there's a lot of studies, and some of them are still pretty early, but it's pretty clear that pretty much every animal has some kind of response to light. And so when you start messing with that, you wonder, well, what does that do to ecosystems? What does that do to nature? In fact, what does that do to us, you know, as we start getting completely lit up during the day or rather the night and you can't see anything except, lights of some sort. So I think really to start addressing this in some ways, what we're trying to really figure out what to do.
So when you think about the Dark Sky Association and these sort of state or region-based offshoots of it, do you think that light pollution is something that gets addressed globally because the sky, you know, we've all heard the song Somewhere Out There, we're all beneath the same big sky,
yeah.
Or is it more of a local or regional issue?
I think it's a global issue. The truth is because this is crazy if you think about this. 80% of the world population right now lives under some type of sky glow. And in the U.S. and Europe, 99% of us experience some type of sky glow. And that's a 2016
sky glow. Is that another term for light pollution?
So what happens, basically what happens is that light goes up in the sky, and because it's so bright, it basically washes out. It reduces the contrast. In other words, you can't see the stars because the clouds are all lit up, or the maybe there's smog in the air or whatever else. And so you have things that are going on where you simply can't see. So what happens when you have sky glow, what it does is it reflects back down on the ground, and then it lights up everything. It's almost like you've got a moon out all the time, no matter what phase the moon really is. And so when you take things like moths and fireflies and animals that maybe navigate, maybe they're trying to hide because it's dark, and well, then if they're completely lit up all the time, then it starts changing how things work.
Well, I'm going to bring an astrophysicist in on this now. He lives in Lawrence and teaches at KU. He's kind of our go-to space guy on Central Standard. Gregory Rudnick, welcome back.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
So do you think it's worth making a distinction between Kansas and Missouri when it comes to light pollution, or are the two states essentially the same place from a cosmic standpoint?
Well, I mean, I think light pollution transcends state boundaries. So I think in that sense, we shouldn't split things up on a state-by-state basis. And I think that people in both states feel the effect of light pollution from other states. It doesn't matter if you're on the Missouri or Kansas side of the state line, you're experiencing the light from the KC metro area. So in that sense, I think it doesn't transcend state line. I mean, it doesn't get limited by state lines. And I think Kansas and Missouri have, in some sense, similar situations in that we have a few big urban centers, but lots of really nice dark areas that we enjoy that the other people in our country don't. And so I think we have kind of the same things at stake in preserving those dark spaces.
Can you explain light pollution from an astrophysicist's standpoint?
So there's different components. From the science and research component, whenever light gets shined up into the atmosphere and reflects back down, and we're trying to look at really, really faint things with big telescopes, that light pollution makes it harder to do that. So we're trying to look at things that are millions of times fainter than what our eye can see with big telescopes. And they're fainter than kind of the very natural faint glow that the sky has, because the sky glows very little amount just from things in the atmosphere glowing. And so when there's additional sources of light pollution, that makes it difficult to do that. So for example, in Kitt Peak, which is a mountain about 45 minutes west of Tucson, Arizona, even though Tucson's much closer, Phoenix, Arizona, which is a much bigger city but farther away, causes a significant amount of sky brightening at that kind of premier astronomical site. And it makes it a little bit harder to do the observations we'd like to do.
So from what kind of a distance does light pollution from an urban center or the suburbs surrounding it or whatever, like how far does that reach?
Well, it's all a question of degrees. There's some measurable effect quite far away. For example, Tucson, I mean, Kitt Peak is 100 miles away from Phoenix, but it is the brightest thing in the sky. It is brighter than Tucson, which is only 30 miles away. So it depends on how big the urban center is. It depends on the quality of the atmosphere. If there's a lot of water vapor in the atmosphere, if the water is clear, if there's haze, all those things influence. But it can easily affect big metro areas can affect the glow of the night sky 100 miles away in cases. So it's not a local effect in that sense.
Are there side effects of light pollution? I mean, our other guest got into this a little bit, but side effects that are concerning beyond just the view we get of the stars, like really substantial environmental fallout?
So there's, I mean, I think the previous speaker addressed this kind of correctly, is that, or say the other guest, is that there's effects on animals. So the diurnal cycle, the fact that animals have a fixed day and night and their behaviors have adapted over, you know, millions of years to be in that environment of a day and night. And when you start disrupting that, not just animals, but plants as well, when you start putting lots of lights in at night, that can affect their rhythms and change how they behave. It also can affect humans. So when we get lots of light, we don't sleep as well. And so, you know, there's lots of places to put in really bright street lights. And if that's right next to your house and shining in your bedroom window, if you don't have really thick drapes, you're not going to sleep as well. And that's going to have health impacts on you. So I think there's an ecological impact on the way plants and animals behave, but also a health impact on humans. And the studies are ongoing on this, but I think they converge, and I'm not a biologist or a medical doctor, but they seem to be converging on lots of light at night being bad for people's sleep, and that's clearly bad for their health.
as someone who has always been fascinated by the night sky, just thinking about the difference between what you personally observed as a kid and what you see when you look up at the sky now, is the difference over the course of your own lifetime dramatic?
So it's hard to say because I grew up in the middle of Chicago. And so, in fact, when I looked up, I didn't see mostly any stars, even when I was a kid. Chicago has been bright since for a long time. But my family went camping all the time. And so I was kind of blessed as a young child to always have access to places a few hours from Chicago where the skies were substantially darker. And a few times near, maybe once or twice, we would go to really dark places like in the Rockies or Canada. And so I was able to see those places, and I'm really happy to see those places are preserved. The cities, if anything, have gotten worse. But they were already pretty bad when I was a child.
Don, I'd like you to jump in on this.
Yes. First, I think it was interesting. I've been doing a bit of a learning thing, but obviously as a new chapter president, and I was asking about dark skies. And in fact, I was talking with some of the folks yesterday, and I said, well, you know, where are the darkest skies? And, you know, you might argue about which particular park's the darkest, but it's pretty much west. When you look in the state of Missouri, there's a guy named John Bortle, B-O-R-T-L-E, a few years ago, came up with a scale of 1 to 9, where 1's really, really dark and 9's really, really bright. And he came up with this process of measuring, and it turns out if you look at the state of Missouri, there are no Bortle 1s at all. It's a Bortle 2 at the very best, and most of the measurements are much higher, you know, 5 or 6 or 7, whatever else, in the state. So,
and Missouri, a higher number means there's more light pollution.
Yeah, that's right. So like a really, like a New York might be a 9, 8 or 9. So I was looking. There's a very cool map, by the way. This is just a fun thing we often do with outreach. If you go to lightpollutionmap.info, you can do a worldwide map, lightpollutionmap.info. You can do this worldwide map. You can touch wherever you live or wherever you want to go, and it'll tell you the measurements of darkness, and it's kind of like an atlas, if you will. It's not as good as those sky quality meters that we'll be putting in around the state. But you can really figure that out, and there's just really no really dark places. So, in effect...
So, wait, what does Missouri look like? When you look up different places in Missouri on that map?
Well, obviously, as our speaker was saying, is that we have Kansas City, Missouri are very bright spots. You can see they're color-coded. You can very much see. And it does, by the way, it does not really, you know, go by state boundaries. It very much goes into the Kansas side of Kansas City. And same with St. Louis on the Illinois side. You got Jefferson City's lit up a little bit. But when you go down south, say Mark Twain Forest, Ozark National Scenic Riverway, Sam A. Baker Park, you got some pretty dark skies. But even then, you're far from being that Bortle 1, which is the really, really dark stuff.
We're going to take a short break, and when we get back, we want to hear from you. Call 816-235-2888 to share your observations and experiences with light pollution. And let us know if you found great spots for stargazing in our area that aren't too polluted with light, at least not yet. 816-235-2888. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're talking about light pollution and the environment, but we are also getting tips for those of you wanting to find a magical spot where you can still see a pitch black sky illuminated by stars, despite all the light pollution making that harder than it should be in a lot of places. My guests are Don Ficken, with us from via St. Louis Public Radio. He's an amateur astronomer and president of the Missouri chapter of the International Dark Sky Association, as well as Gregory Rednick, with us from KU's Department of Physics and Astronomy. Hi again, Don.
Good morning.
And hi again, Greg.
Hi there.
So, Greg, we just heard a little bit about this picture of Missouri. Give me the picture of what Kansas looks like from a relative light and dark sky situation.
I mean, I think from my perspective, around the KC area, things are bright. Around even Lawrence, things are bright. Around Topeka, the big metro areas, but most of Kansas is empty of metro areas. And so even if you go 10 or 20 miles away from Lawrence, you already start seeing things that are considerably darker. So Don pointed out that nowhere in Missouri do you actually get to the darkest possible skies. But I think that there are many places that people can go to kind of see what they've been missing. And I think one reason that people don't appreciate the importance of dark skies is that they don't really know what it looks like to actually be in a dark sky. When I teach class, I ask how many students, for example, have seen the Milky Way, and many of them never have. And that's because they've never actually gone 20 miles outside of a big city or a town and looked up. And so I think in Kansas, we're lucky that it doesn't take very much to get to a place where you can see dark skies. I think the same is for Missouri. You could go halfway between Kansas City and Columbia, go off the highway a bit and look up. And so it's not also just getting away from the big cities. It's also dealing with kind of the local light sources. So you could be in the darkest place in the world, but if there's a big light in the driveway that you're standing in shining right in your eyes, it's not going to help. So you need to go both to kind of a dark spot, anywhere reasonably far from any kind of major town, and then get to a place where you're not getting light shine right in your eyes. So right next to a highway isn't a good idea, for example, because the headlights will be coming right into your eyes. So getting a little bit off the beaten path, but not much, just to kind of shield your immediate field of view. And already then you can see the Milky Way. You can even see galaxies. There's that one galaxy that you can see just with your own eyes. It's the most distant object in the universe that you can see without a telescope. And you can see it easily from dark spaces in Kansas and Missouri. So in that sense, even though things aren't as good as they necessarily could be, there's still a lot for people to see in those areas.
So would you be willing to share your favorite dark space around here?
Around here? You know, I
consider all of Kansas to be around here for
okay,
our
yeah, no, that's fine. I mean, I have to be honest, I don't have a favorite dark space. Anytime I go outside, I look up. That's kind of just what I do as an astronomer. And you can tell when you go to meetings of astronomers, everybody kind of goes outside and the first thing they do is just kind of look up and see what's up. And so literally. And so anytime I'm at a friend's house out in the country, I have a friend who lives out by Oskaloosa. And when we're out their house, that's north of Lawrence a bit, I go up and look up and I can see really amazing skies. If you go to any of the kind of the big state parks in the area, even kind of Clinton Lake State Park, which is not far from Lawrence at all. But if you go to Clinton Lake State Park, you're already far enough away from Lawrence where the skies are considerably better than they are inside Lawrence itself. And so I really think there's so many good places that most people with a car have easy access to get out of the city. It's not like everybody needs to go to the very northwestern edge of Kansas, which may be the darkest spot in the state. But when you make the bar really high, so that people think, oh, the only way I can get the dark skies is by going really, really far away, then nobody ever does it. I think you want to get people that experience by going anywhere that's substantially darker than where they currently are. And that's when they see the big change.
I want to talk to a caller. There's still a little bit of time to join this conversation at 816-235-2888. Your own experience with either light pollution or escaping from it is what we're looking for. Dale is calling us from Pleasant Hill. Hi, Dale. What's your story?
Oh, I'm just, anytime I hear about starry skies, I can't help but recall my favorite spot. And it is in the middle of an 83-mile stretch of the Rio Grande, just outside of Big Bend National Park. It's a, contrary to your previous contributor there, it does take some work to get there. But there is a place in that 83-mile stretch on the river where you can camp. It's where Panther Canyon comes in on the Texas side.
Oh, Dale, river. our line is breaking up a little bit. I want to try. Can you just? It sounds like you're going to somewhere near Big Bend National Park. Can you just tell us what this experience does for you to go to a dark place as like almost a pilgrimage, it sounds like?
Okay, well, what I was telling the woman when I called in is that I used to tell my friends that I would go there every year or two to recharge my spiritual batteries. And there's nothing more suited to that than sleeping out on the ground on a thermarest, no tent, going to sleep, staring up at that night sky and feeling this sense of awe and wonder.
Dale, yeah. Thank you for that call. I'm going to get our guests' responses to that because it's not just an idea for a location, which is a road trip to Big Bend National Park in Texas, but also, Don, is this the experience that you share, that the dark sky and the setting of the dark sky is something that can recharge your battery?
Yeah, I'm with Gregory on this. You don't really have to, at least at this point, to go that far, really in Missouri or Kansas for that matter, to get some dark skies. And when we get, even in the city, I will say, when we start showing people some of the wonderful objects, if you know where to find them, they're there. But when you go out and you can literally look up without anything, just look and you can see these white patches of things in the sky. It's just really awe-inspiring. I will say that the thing that I want to stress here is that we're talking a little bit about static, right, what we have at the moment. And here's the thing, is that light pollution from 2012 to 2016 is increasing at 2% per year. So the concern is that things are changing fairly rapidly, and what we think is good today is changing very quickly. And there's one little study, I want to make sure that I get this in, our discussion here, about bird migrations and how this is really messing them up. And this just came out, actually. Gregory was talking about Chicago. Chicago, it turns out to be the number one most dangerous city for birds for migration in both spring and fall. But get this, Kansas City is number seven.
Whoa.
And number eight for fall migration. St. Louis, we try to beat you here, we're number five for spring migration and number six for fall migrations. So there's definitely effects going on, and it's not a matter of talking. I mean, if we could freeze today, I probably wouldn't be doing the Missouri chapter of IDA kind of thing. But my concern is changing rapidly, and that's the big concern. What do we have to do to slow this down? I would like to keep those skies as dark as we can.
And well, do you have an answer to that? What do we have to do to slow this down?
Well, I think the real question is really education to start with. Even people that I know that are nature lovers are not thinking about what they're doing. They're buying these lights. They're pointing them up. They're lighting up the sky. And, you know, that's, you might say that's an environmental thing, but it's also just a lot of wasted money. We're literally talking about a significant, like 30% of outdoor light is a waste, maybe $3 billion a year of just pointed up light. And it takes like almost 900 million trees annually just to replace that. It's crazy when you think about it. Why would you just waste money to do to light up? And we're simply lighting more than we need.
Okay, I take that point, and now I'm going to return to advice on places to see the stars in the sky. We have Jackie calling us from Overland Park. Hi, Jackie.
Good morning. Hi, Dawn.
Good morning.
What do you recommend, Jackie?
Well, for the people here in the city, the closest and best place to go is just south, about 30 miles south of Kansas City, to Powell Observatory. It's in Lewisburg, Kansas, and the skies are a lot darker down there. And yes, you can see the great Andromeda Galaxy from their naked eye.
So, and can anyone go? Anyone can just go to this observatory?
Anyone can go. Yeah, it's open every Saturday night to the public from May through October.
That's cool. So this is in Lewisburg, yeah. Kansas. Thank you, Jackie. And we have some callers. One is asking a question, but the other, I think, is proposing an answer to that very question. So I want to turn to Rick in Overland Park. Hi, Rick.
Hi.
What do you want to share?
Well, I just wanted to plug Astronomers Without Borders. They're an organization that sells a telescope that's fairly easy to use, inexpensive, highly rated by Sky and Telescope and other magazines. It's about $200, and they use the profits to share telescopes with less fortunate folks in undeveloped areas in Africa and South America and so on.
And so
it's a great little telescope, and it makes it possible to see things even in town, like the planets and so on, sharing those with the grandkids. And then it's easily portable.
Does it have some sort of technology that helps the viewer somehow get past the light pollution?
No, it really doesn't. But what it does, kind of back to the comments that were made earlier, that you don't have to be, I mean, we take it to Shawnee Mission Park, you know. Obviously, you're not going to see dark sky objects, but you're going to see things just looking up that might spark the interest in the kids and other adults, you know, and get people thinking about the whole subject more, which then in turn can be kind of a groundswell for being in favor of changing our lights around our street lights and our lights at our houses and that kind of thing. Just getting people thinking about it.
Yeah, Rick, thank you so much.
One of my favorites, one spot, the cattle pens on the way down on I-35. It's always a good place to stop if you're heading in that direction.
Okay, thank you. And Don, my question here is, would you encourage people to get tools for helping them see better in light pollution, if such a thing even exists? Or would you encourage people to focus on fighting the light pollution?
I think it's a little bit of both. By the way, I've used that telescope. I know Astronomers Without Borders, and that's a great telescope. We do a program in St. Louis, by the way. We have what's called library telescopes, where we have telescopes you can check out from the library and even binoculars now, and there's over 160 of those things. And we use those as tools to teach people that you can actually find things like the moon, planets, bright objects, even in the city, which makes them, by the way, start appreciating if they were to check that telescope out, let's say for 2 weeks, and take it out to dark skies, that they can see a lot more. So there's really a lot to work with in some of those tools. But I think also, and this is just me from a personal journey, because, you know, quite honestly, a year and a half ago, I wasn't thinking that much about light pollution, except as an amateur astronomer, I can see it changing around my home, right? But as I'm starting really to look at this and say, wow, the skies are really, in fact, changing a lot. And what do I need to do about that? I'm now realizing, for example, that when you get a really bright light and you're looking at that light, if there's a person standing behind that light, you can't see them until you put your hand over the light in some way, stop it down, and suddenly can see behind that. So the idea that maybe more light is better is not necessarily the smartest thing. And I think once you start recognizing that's happening, then maybe you can make some changes.
Well, Don, thank you so much. And before we go, I want both of you to answer this. We are hearing about the Boundary Waters in Minnesota as a great place to go stargazing. Either of you been there?
I've been up by the Boundary Waters. In fact, I was just up in that area in Ontario 2 weeks ago, and it was absolutely amazing. You're far away from big cities. We were a few hours north of Toronto. I've been to the Boundary Waters, and it's absolutely stunning. I think it gives you that sense of place in the universe when you look up and you realize that all those little dots you see up there are stars like our sun, and they may have planets around them. And if you go out and see thousands of them when you look up, that kind of puts you in a unique perspective of seeing where we are.
We have to leave it there. Gregory Rudnick with us from KU and Lawrence. Thank you for guiding our weekend stargazing activities. And thank you to Don Finken as well. He is with us from the International Dark Sky Association Missouri chapter. You can check out both of this morning's conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, have you heard of SprayCMO? If not, you will tomorrow at 10. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Ann Kniggendorf, Aviva Okeson-Haberman, and intern Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman.